You are listening to Heal Your Natural Wellness Podcast, episode number 20. Today, we're talking about understanding hormones, allergies, histamine and estrogen, hormone test timing, the connection between thyroid and fertility. Hey everyone, Astrid here. Welcome to Healing Natural Wellness Podcast. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for tuning in. The Heal You Natural Wellness Podcast is produced twice a month for your enjoyment, and show notes are found at healyounaturally.com/podcasts. Come back often and feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed or iTunes, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Stitches, Google, Alexa Play, Spotify, and all major podcast directories. You can also follow me on Twitter at @heal_naturally and on Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest at @healyounaturally. All links are in the show notes. Now let's get into the show. Hey everyone, today I have a phenomenal guest. Her name is Dr. Carrie Jones, and I'm going to read a little bit about her journey. I'm going to give you a little bit of the bio, and we're going to jump right in. So Dr. Carrie Jones is an internationally recognized speaker, consultant, and educator on the topic of women's health and hormones. She graduated from the National University of Natural Medicine, School of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, Oregon, where she also completed her two-year residency in women's health, hormones, and endocrinology. Later, she graduated from Grand Canyon University, Master's of Public Health Program with a goal of doing more international education. She was adjunct faculty for many years teaching gynecology and advanced endocrinology, fertility, and has been the medical director for two large integrative clinics in Portland. She is the medical director for Precision Analytical Inc., creators of the Dutch hormone test. Welcome to the Heal Your Natural Wellness Podcast, Dr. Carrie.
No, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. It's great to have you. And as usual, guys, we're going to jump right in. And so, Carrie, why don't you briefly tell us about your journey into naturopathic medicine and the complex world of hormones? How did it all start?
And the complex world of hormones is right. So I have always known since I was a little kid that I wanted to be a women's health doctor. I thought I wanted to do OBGYN and pediatrics and just everything around women's health. And as I moved into college, I was volunteering at two different hospitals. Mm-hmm. One hospital, I did a lot of outreach, diabetes education, heart hypertension education, dietary education, and I loved it. I had such a great experience. And in the other hospital, I worked in the pediatric wing, and it was very cold, and it was very sterile, and it was very not the kind of medicine I wanted to practice. And so I ended up moving on a whim to Oregon. I moved to Oregon and I found naturopathic medicine and I went, oh, this is what I want to do. I want to be integrative in my approach. I want to address the root cause. I want to spend a lot of time with my patients, not the standard 8 minutes. And here we are. And I focused on women's and hormones. I did my residency in hormones and endocrinology. My practices were primarily women. I did have a big gynecology bent to my practice. So not a lot of men want to see me because they don't want to talk about, I'm not the girl they want to talk about their erectile issues with or their prostate issues. And now I work for a hormone lab. So I just literally swim in hormones all the time.
I know. You know what? I love it so much. Like I met you just a few months ago, but I was hooked because I find hormones fascinating. And I like to call you the queen of hormones. I don't know if you know it, but when I've shared your posts, that's what I refer to because you're so knowledgeable. And so I really, I'm glad that we're going to talk about this. It's very important. And that's going to bring me to reading last night in terms of statistics and like that. And so just before we dive in, I want to share some startling statistics with the audience and obviously with you. So in the United States, women generally live long and healthy lives when compared to other less developed countries, but we still face many health issues involving cancer, disease, mental health, and fertility. In 2017, heart disease and cancer were the leading causes of death among women in the United States, accounting for a combined 43% of all female deaths. The most common type of cancer among women in the United States was breast cancer, of which there will be an estimate of 268,000 new cases in 2019. And although rates of breast cancer have increased, deaths have been steadily decreasing since 1950. Similarly, although heart disease heart diseases are the leading cause of death among women, rates of death from such diseases have decreased over the past 60 years, reaching a low of 129.6 deaths per 100,000 population in 2017. So, you know, hormones are, managing hormones is extremely important because it is, these diseases are tied up to hormones. What do you think about those statistics? Yeah.
So it's really interesting, especially now, given everything that's happening. First, we start with a pandemic because of COVID, and then we move into, you know, what's happening across the nation. And I think the pandemic was global, and it's the amount of stress the world has been under. Cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine, those are our stress hormones. And in the short term acute, you get a bad text, you have a bad day, you get mad at something at work, you almost get in a car accident. Those short term acute stressors, the hormones should go up, handle business, and then go back down. And unfortunately, what the world has experienced is they've started out in about March of having a lot of stress, anxiety, hypervigilance, concern, worry, insomnia, and knowing what we know about prior outbreaks, whether it was Ebola, whether it was SARS, whether it was whatever it was, we know that the long-term effect in those areas caused increased chronic disease. Right. Now we have it on a global scale that's compounded even worse with George Floyd's death. And we as healthcare practitioners are going to start seeing, I think, an increase, unfortunately, in chronic disease, heart disease being a big one, but metabolic syndromes, so diabetes, high blood pressure, cholesterol issues. And we're already at risk. We're already at risk as a population, but as women. And I'm just projecting in the future. I think us as health, you and I as healthcare practitioners are going to start asking, how did you handle 2020? What happened for you in 2020? Did this, how were you before 2020? And did this start after 2020? And we're going to hear that a lot. We're going to hear a lot of women say, well, yeah, it was, you know, before it was, you know, a pain or it was rough, but now, you know, now I can't get my blood sugar under control. Now I can't get my blood pressure under control. Now I can't get my menopausal symptoms under control. Now I can't get pregnant, whatever it is. And I think I think just moving forward, we're going to see a lot. It's going to take a big toll on health. Our health. Everyone talks about the economy. Everyone talks about relations. Everyone talks about, you know, whatever, but nobody health. Talks about health. And I think it's going
to
be huge.
I know it's very unfortunate to think about. And, you know, I've spoken to a couple of friends and like that. And so their mom's high blood pressure, sugar imbalances. I actually test myself because both my parents are diabetic. I've always had hormonal issues. I battle with the weight. I work out. Mm-hmm. I have like a complex metabolism, but I'm addressing it slowly the more I learn. Right. So we're all on a healing journey, but thank you for touching on that, guys. And we're going to talk about this maybe a little later. So hopefully we have some time on how to address stress. I know that we sound like broken records when we talk about it in the podcast, right? Like meditate, do this and that. But right now it's so important. And this is, you know, right now more than ever. And for us women, it's crucial to self-care, you know, take time for self-care, manage stress. We've been under a lot of stress for, like Dr. Carrie said, 3 months or more. That's going to take a toll. Let's try to reverse that a little bit and start right now being a little bit more proactive in terms of stress management. Very important. Thank you so much for touching on that. We're going to jump to the next question. Let's talk about women of color and fibroids, and can fibroids be reversed without medication?
So with fibroids in general, I believe the statistic is 80% of women will develop a fibroid in their lifetime. Most women don't know it. No, I have fibroids and had no idea. I had to have an ultrasound for an IUD that decided to expel itself. Oh, wow. And they were like, oh, did you know you had a fibroids? I'm like, nope, had no idea. Thank goodness I don't have the symptoms. I don't have my fibroids on the outside and on the inside. So I don't have pain. I don't have heavy periods. I don't, you know, clots, things mm-hmm. like that. But, you know, I'm part of the statistic. However, Black women tend to have increased risk for fibroids over those who are white or Hispanic. So what's interesting is that a friend of mine is really into genomics, SNP testing, DNA, stuff like that. And I said to him, why? Why is it? First of all, why do women, is it genetic? And why do women get so many fibroids? And he said, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the genomic testing, a lot of that SNP testing, people who are into getting, you know, like 23andMe, finding out their DNA, he said most of that research is only done on Caucasians. Mm. And not on people of color. So he said, we actually don't really know. I'm sure there's a genetic component to it for Black women, but he's like, we don't really know. I had a really neat comment on my Instagram post I posted about this, where somebody said, do you think the fibroid formation is trauma? Do you think the trauma has to go somewhere? So as a result, women, they, you know, we like the body walls it off. It emotionally walls it off. And as a woman, because we can make fibroids, you know, we up with our uterus right. and the hormone implant may impact, maybe it's walled off trauma. And I thought, oh my gosh, there's a form of medicine called transgenerational, which means trauma and things that have happened that gets passed on through the generations. And maybe you never have experienced it, you know, maybe, it gets studied a lot with those who went through World War II, you know, the Jewish who were in concentration camps, and then subsequently their generations of their children, their grandchildren, their, you know, great grandchildren. So they do a lot of research into that, and they have found things that have get passed down, or those who come from like of Irish descent, and you know, like the grandparents and great grandparents who lived through the famine. Then the body, the metabolism adjusts so that the subsequent offspring will can survive better under low food, right? Or no right. food, and tend to put on weight. And so I thought, that's so interesting. There's so much trauma with a lot of generations that maybe we're looking at fibroids only from a science medicine point of view. And we need to look at it a little bit more like, how are you? What happened to you? What happened to your tell me about your family line. Tell me about your lineage. And let's go from
wow,
there.
Wow, that is mind blowing.
I haven't looked into it with fibroids in particular, but when that woman commented, I thought, oh, yes,
it's very possible, right? Yeah. We talked about mm-hmm. that with Dr. Jess, in one of my previous podcasts, and she was actually talking about, and I've been hearing it more and more that, you know, they are, I think we froze. Are we good? There are, you know, trauma. It also can reflect in other areas, you know, heart disease, mm-hmm. Mental, obviously. And then this now, it's just fascinating. And so, I found your post pretty interesting. And, you know, especially right now that we're mm-hmm. the raising awareness and all this, I thought it was relevant to include that question, because those are things that are not addressed, you know,
right.
trauma. And, you know, some people may feel weird. And I was reading one of your, I think, comments or something you said, somebody said in one of your posts, why do you refer to race? Why do you have to? Hello, that's very important. It's reality. You know, we are predisposed right. sometimes are, for example, for Hispanics. I was reading one of mm-hmm. the statistics, and it's just the reality, guys. You know, I'm all open to all of that. And I'm not Hispanic American right. because I wasn't born here. I was actually raised in Colombia. But for Hispanic Americans, they are number two on the list of the American Diabetes Association for developing diabetes. So, you know, I would like to reach, that's another whole other story, but you know, you have to address these topics, right? So
in medicine, it's, we get taught it in medical school, and because Instagram, where I usually hang out, only gives you so much space to write, you know, so when I'm educating about estrogen or progesterone or cortisol or insomnia or fertility or menopause, you know, I'm just, it's a quick, it's a, just a couple of paragraphs, you know, I'm just trying to get the point across and have you be able to digest it and go, okay, this is what's happening. Oh, that's what that hormone does. That's great. And, but when it comes to actual, you know, race, it's just like you said, I mean, I was looking at breast cancer statistics. White women are more likely to get breast cancer, but Black women are more likely to die from it. And that's, as a healthcare practitioner, that's important to know, you know, like that's important to know. And just like you said, diabetes is a big one. Fibroids are a big one. And just to point out, like, hey, look, if you are whatever race I'm talking about, let's say fibroids, if you are a Black woman and you are reading my post and you go, holy crap, I have horrible periods, heavy periods. It never dawned on me I might have a fibroid. Go talk to your doctor and be like, look, I'm more likely to develop fibroids. Can we do an ultrasound? And then you'll have your answer versus suffering from super heavy periods, maybe cramps, you know, feeling bloated, depending how big your fibroid is. And then hopefully you can get it addressed. And I was like, of course I'm going to point that out, because I don't want women, any woman, to just think their symptoms are, you know, like, well, that's common. That's what women go through. It's like, well, common doesn't mean normal.
So. Yeah, that's fantastic. You know, that's also why I like the way you address things is all pretty genuine, and it comes from, and I think I see that a lot in you know, the functional medicine, naturopathic field. You know, there are other doctors too that care, but I noticed that with a lot of the, in our industry, the care, you know, it comes from a place of love. It's never from a place of, you know, judging or anything like that. And so those posts like that are great, guys, because, you know, you sit down like Carrie said, you know, hey, maybe my symptoms are related to my heritage, you know, who knows? So that's great. Now I just wanted to read a little something that I found. There's a Dr. Laura Bryden, and she's referred to the period revolutionary. I actually didn't know about her, but this, I found something pretty fascinating. Iodine helps with breast pain, premenstrual mood symptoms, and the prevention of ovarian cysts. It works by promoting healthy estrogen metabolism, down-regulating estrogen receptors, and stabilizing estrogen-sensitive tissue, including breasts, uterus, ovaries, and the brain. Iodine's anti-estrogen effect makes it one of the best treatments for estrogen excess or estrogen dominance. So iodine for women's health. You were, you know, I asked Dr. Carrie before, and she agreed with that, you know, before we talked. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that?
So the part that I love the best is that it decreases the sensitivity of estrogen receptors. And so think of it like a lock and a key. So if estrogen is the key and the lock is the receptor, so your estrogen binds to your receptor and it turns it on. But what if it's supposed to only do it like at a scale of 1 to 10? Let's say it's only supposed to do it like a 5, but your receptor is super sensitive. So now when your estrogen binds, it's like, boom, 10. And then we get really bad breast pain, right? We're like, oh, like everything hurts. Don't touch. You don't want your partner to touch. You don't want to wear a bra. Like everything's annoying, right? And some women get it in like specific places. They're like, it hurts right here. Like, why does it hurt right here? You know? And then they get their period and then their estrogen falls. So there's no keys to fit in the locks, and then it goes away. So what estrogen does is it takes you from a 10 and it brings you back down again. So you're not as sensitive. Not estrogen, iodine. Iodine brings it from a 10 and pulls it down. So you're not as sensitive. So I do commonly use or recommend iodine for tender breasts. You have to be careful though, because you don't want your iodine to mess with your thyroid. So if you have a thyroid condition, if you have hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's, do be careful with iodine. Talk to your practitioner about it. There is some good literature to say that if you take iodine, you should take selenium with it or eat selenium foods for a balance. It's kind of a ratio, especially with Hashimoto's.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah. And it may not be iodine. Other things affect tender breasts, since we're on the topic. Vitamin E, low vitamin E can increase tender breasts. Unfortunately, I hate to tell everyone this, but coffee and chocolate, caffeine, but like coffee seems to be the biggest offender. Coffee and chocolate have an ingredient in it that can make breasts tender. And I've had more women tell me, like, I cut out coffee or I cut out chocolate. Yes, all chocolate, doesn't matter. And they're like, my breast tenderness went away. I'm like, yeah, I know. I'm sorry. Wow. It's so not fair.
I know it's not. And we love chocolate. And we actually, it's so ironic because we crave chocolate during that, that the time of the month. Right. And so, but listen, like I always say, you know, it's all about, what works for you, and you have to make sacrifices, you know, in order to feel well. You know, sometimes just a little sacrifice is going to go a long way. So iodine for women's health, I was reading iodine can be effective nutritional treatment for the following women's health conditions: fibrocystic breasts, breast cysts and pain, ovulation pain, prevention of ovarian cysts, irregular periods, including some type of PCOS, prevention of fibroids, heavy periods, endometriosis, premenstrual mood symptoms, including PMS and PMDD. One thing I love about Dr. Carey is that she always says, you could supplement with this, but be careful because it might mess with that, you know. So definitely follow her on Instagram. Her posts are extremely informative. Instagram, Facebook, everywhere you can follow her, because she always has the good info, but she's always so very cautious and always telling you, you know, I can give you amounts, ratios, but you get the information, you go to your doctor, and those are amazing tools. So thank you for addressing that. So we're going to jump to the next question. Yeah. Why don't you tell us about, we're just going to kind of like move a little bit towards a completely different topic, but it's also tied up. Why don't you tell us about allergies, histamine, and estrogen, and why allergies can be worse during PMS?
Yeah, which is so funny. So for those listening, right before we went live, I sneezed. Yes. And it's also right before my period too. And I was like, these allergies. So Whoever's ever experienced allergies. Now, allergies can be environmental. We write grass, pollen, mold, trees, this time, especially in the spring or in the fall. Allergies can happen though because of food. You could be like wine, red wine will set people off. Cheeses will set people off. Fermented stuff, so, you know, beer, kombucha, because it's fermented, sometimes will set people off. Some people can't eat leftovers. They'll eat at a restaurant, and well, when we used to be able to do that. And then the next day they'll have leftovers and they're like, I just feel really kind of itchy, or my nose is itchy, or I feel kind of bloated. I just feel kind of, and histamine increases on that food. And so, bacteria on that food then increases histamine. So what happens is we have these cells in our body called mast cells. And when they break apart, when they blow up, one of the things they release is called histamine. And a mast cell is to help you deal with things such as allergies. Well, histamine makes you tired. So it's when you have allergies, a lot of people go, man, this time of year, and I'm sneezing and sniffing and my eyes are watering, like I'm really tired. Histamine makes you tired. But interestingly, estrogen slows the breakdown of histamine. You have an enzyme called DAO, and it breaks down histamine, particularly in your gut, in your down in your GI tract. And when you have high estrogen, we tend as women tend to have high estrogen normally right before we ovulate. And if we have an imbalance, we have it around close to our period, right? That PMS time, because it's imbalanced with progesterone. And what happens is the body can't get rid of histamine like it wants to. So women will say to me, my allergies are worse at PMS. My scratchy throat, my itchy skin, my itchy scalp, these crazy rashes are worse at PMS. I can't drink wine at PMS. I get worse. And then my period comes and it goes away. I'm like, because estrogen can affect it. So histamine is a problem. It can be a problem, but estrogen is a driver. So for women, it's hand in hand. It's hand in hand.
Wow. That's interesting.
And so many commenters who saw my post were like now, right? It's a bad allergy season. It's a bad allergy season. And as a result, so many women are having horrible allergies. I've had so many women write me and say, I never had allergies until 2020. I'm like, of course not. Right. Like, of course, 2020 is the year you develop allergies. Like, why not? Let's just throw something else on there. And on top of it, our periods are worse because we're stressed, and therefore our allergies get worse. Our histamine breakdown gets worse.
Wow. That's,
we feel more sensitive to foods. Yeah. It's a vicious cycle.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That is pretty fascinating. You see how complex everything is. But at the same time, don't panic, guys, because Dr. Kerry is going to give us all, okay, most of the answers to this. I just wanted to, I found something really cool on her post, and it said in an endometriosis rat study, they said estrogen, like Dr. Kerry said, may mediate the pathogenesis of endometriosis by activating mast cells, which may be associated with increasing TNF-A and
alpha.
What is that? The TNF-A?
TNF-alpha, which is it increases inflammation.
Got it. Thank you. And NGF levels. So, you know.
So for women with endometriosis, it's a lot of pain, right? Pain. It's a lot of inflammation. And so those same mast cells in rat studies, but I really fully believe it happens in women too. Those same mast cells, they break apart in the abdomen, and that histamine, you know, increases inflammation in the area. So now she's getting close to her period. She has higher estrogen. She has a lot of inflammation because of her endometriosis. And now she has all this histamine that's making the inflammation worse.
Wow.
It's not fair.
It's not. It's so just real quick, what would be like one or two solutions or something that you would recommend to your patients, you know, when they have this situation?
So I definitely recommend, so I'll give you a couple. So, you can do over-the-counter allergy medication if it's right for you. People take Zyrtec or Claritin or things like that. And so maybe that's the right course for you, especially if you have severe endometriosis. Mm. Then naturally, though, we're looking at some supplements that help to improve the allergic reaction. So we're looking at things like quercetin with a Q. We're looking at bromelain. We're looking at N-acetylcysteine, NAC. We're looking at glutathione. We're looking at ways to get your estrogen safely out of the body through estrogen detoxification. So liver, anything you can do for liver health. Mm-hmm. We're looking at the enzyme that I was talking about earlier. It's called DAO. You can actually buy it as a supplement. You can buy DAO enzyme. And when you take or eat foods or drink wine and your face gets flushed and your nose gets stuffy, you can take the DAO enzyme to help. It's not a magic pill, but it is helpful. Probiotics. Yep. Probiotics can be really helpful. Vitamin C can be really helpful. It's stabilizing. So the mast cells, so they don't break apart, but keeps them together. So there's definitely a lot of, you know, good options out there for people.
Excellent. I just wanted to say, I know the fiber, correct me if I'm wrong, fiber moves estrogen out of the body. So, right? So don't forget to add that, you know, fiber in, you know, carrots. One of the natural ways to increase that that fiber is carrots. If you're not, you know, watching your sugars and stuff like I am. So you could, you know, consume carrots and everything, you know, natural sources of fiber to move that estrogen out of the body, which is something that I learned recently, which is pretty incredible, right?
Yeah. It binds it up, right? It binds up. So when estrogen is supposed to leave the body, it goes through two phases of detox in the liver, and then it moves in out through the kidneys. So you urinate it out, or it goes through your gut, right? So you poop it out. But if you have if you have constipation or you're slow to go, then what happens is the body pulls estrogen back inside of you and lets it recirculate. And now you have an estrogen problem because it was supposed to leave and it got pulled back inside. Oh, wow. So you increase your fiber. And with carrots in particular, you want organic carrots, and you don't want to peel them, which is weird for a lot of people. You want the outer skin on.
Probiotics.
Clean them. Clean them, right? Like clean them. But the fiber on the outside of the carrot is different than the fiber on the inside. And it's what helps bind to estrogen and get it out. I've had more women tell me they just started eating a couple carrots. Like they just wash it, the organic carrots, whole, not the baby carrots, the whole, but like a real carrot, the whole carrot. And they're like, you know, I added in two or three whole carrots a day and my PMS symptoms are so much better. It's the fiber.
Wow. Mm-hmm. You know what? I completely forgot about that. And also the skin, you know, like I also buy the organic carrots, a huge one. So I used to juice them. Now I don't do that anymore because it's too much, but sugar. But also when you keep that skin, there is probiotics in it, which is going to feed the probiotics. So double win-win situation. Yep.
Double thumbs up.
Awesome. Okay. That was great. So, now we know, guys, fiber, all of that good stuff. I'm going to add, everything that, Dr. Kerry said to her dedicated page on my podcast, so you get that in the notes. Now we're going to jump to the next question. And in your Instagram, one of your Instagram posts, you had a 4-minute video talking about cortisol and mitochondria. Why don't you tell us about the process and where cortisol is made?
Yeah. So well, we all learned in school that mitochondria are cellular powerhouses. They make something called ATP, which really provides energy. It gives us energy for the body. So, but mitochondria, it turns out when you need to make a cortisol hormone, so your cortisol is made in your adrenal glands, in a layer of your adrenal glands. Your adrenal glands sit on top of your kidneys. You have two of them. And then what happens is the brain tells the adrenal gland, like, hey, there's some stress going on, make some cortisol. So what happens is you have this really cool protein called STAR, and it binds to cholesterol. And then cholesterol moves in through the mitochondria, and the very first step of making cortisol happens. So the very first step of producing cortisol is in the mitochondria. Then it leaves the mitochondria. It goes to a different part of your cells called the endoplasmic reticulum. And it goes through two more steps and comes back into the mitochondria. So to make cortisol, to handle stress, we start and stop in the mitochondria. Now, does this mean that, like some people say, well, I have high cortisol, is this a mitochondrial problem? Nope, not necessarily. It's when you're low, you might. If you're really tired, you're burned out, you had a lot of high stress, and now you just feel low and sluggish and unmotivated and blah. Maybe you've done testing and your cortisol's low. Definitely starts with the brain, but because the brain is the primary signaler. That's where the big message comes from. But the mitochondria is where the action happens. And so we need to have healthy mitochondria.
Wow. That's pretty interesting. Another question that I wanted, since we're in this topic of the cortisol, I think that's part of one of my questions, but just real quick with this one, when is the best time to test cortisol? Because I had mine tested. I actually had it literally, guys, fight with my doctor because he's like, why do you need to test cortisol? And why do you need, I'm like, why not? I actually go to my doctors and I tell them the lab work to run, you know, the tests that I would like. So what are the best times? I do know that, you know, I actually wanted to test it in the afternoon and they said it wasn't necessary. What are the best times to test cortisol?
Yeah. So it depends how you're testing it. Cortisol runs on what we call a circadian rhythm. It's to be high in the morning and low at night. So most of the time when I'm testing cortisol, I'm doing 4 points in the day. I'm doing in the morning, a couple hours later, around dinner, and before bed. And if somebody has insomnia, I test them when they have insomnia. But I'm doing it an easier way. I'm having them do it as a urine test. So like urinate on pieces of filter paper, which is through the Dutch test, or I'm doing saliva. So I'm having them stick cotton swabs in their mouth, off and on throughout the day. And then I'm tracking their entire pattern. I want the pattern. But if you go get your blood drawn, the problem with cortisol and a blood draw is that your cortisol, there's free cortisol that's free and active and floating around and binding to receptors and turning things on. And then there's cortisol that's bound up. And when it's bound up, it's literally in like on a bus and it can't get off the bus. It can't bind. It can't turn anything on. It can't do anything. Oh. So when you get a blood draw, let's pretend your blood draw number is 10. What I can't, it's 10 is a combination of everything. I can't tell you what's free and what's bound up. So you may have 9 free and 1 bound, or 9 bound and 1 free. And this is a big difference because the more free you have, that's what's active and does the things. So a blood draws are good, like quick screening, but it doesn't give me all the information I need to know. So then I turn to saliva testing or dried urine testing because I want to understand what's going on with the free hormone and the pattern throughout the day.
Wow.
Because you want it in the afternoon. Your cortisol may look great in the morning, but in the afternoon, maybe you spike up. Or maybe you plummet, maybe you like sink. Maybe people have insomnia and it's because their cortisol, you know, goes way up. But if you just tested in the morning, if your doctor said, all right, let's test you at 9 a.m., you're like, except I can't sleep at night. then like we have to get that whole pattern, because I want to know what happens before bed. Does your cortisol start to go up? And that's not good.
You know what? Actually, that's what happened to me. And I realized, you know, this one, obviously educated myself. And I, one time a friend of mine said, why is it that by 10 o'clock, 11, you have all this energy and I'm passing out and you're still on the floor? And I'm like, you're right. I think to this day, I still sometimes I'm like cleaning a tent and my husband's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I don't know. I just gotta get this. And it's like, why do I have all this energy? Yeah. So that's something that's concerning that I think I want to address. I want to go for the Dutch test real soon, because I know for a fact that a lot of my issues are hormonal. I'm supposed to be a night owl. I enjoy working at night and all this, but I think that's also part of the reason why I've had like insulin resistance issues and all of that. Mm. And I'm trying to address it. So I definitely, because I can't figure it out at this point, I think I need the expert. So Dutch test, and you are pretty much next, because I can't figure it out. And it's starting to get concerning, because with the, you know, I'm 42, you know, earlier as you're, when you're younger, you're able to stay up, you know, a little and late, and it doesn't affect you. I've been testing since I was like early 20s, because like I said, both my parents were diabetic. My grandparents changed the diet and everything else. But regardless, because of the lack of sleep, I think that's what messes you up. Deviating one more time from the topic. When your insulin and leptin levels are out of control, Why is that?
So they're from two different areas. So when you eat, you have glucose, you have blood sugar, and then to push the blood sugar into the cells so it can be used up, you need insulin. So in this case, insulin is the key that opens the door and allows glucose to come in. But if you have broken doors, your insulin's, it's not working, you get what's called insulin resistance. So you have all this blood sugar floating around, and then you have all this insulin, and the brain is like, hello, I have no energy in the cells. Nothing's in the cells. I'm scanning your body and there is nothing in the cells. I am hungry and I am tired and this isn't working for me. And so it makes, so you eat more, but so it gets in this vicious circle and we become diabetic with insulin resistance. Leptin is made right out of your fat tissue, and it too is used as a signal. So when your fat tissue is full, so to speak, your fat releases leptin and it goes to your brain, and it should say to your brain, hey, look, she's full. Make her not hungry anymore. And let's switch her to energy burning. Let's burn some of this extra off. And the brain's like, yeah, cool, got it. But what can happen is that the leptin can't get into the brain, can't cross that membrane, that barrier, or it can't bind to its own receptor. And so the brain is like, where's leptin? I guess we're still hungry. I guess we'll continue to gain weight. I guess I won't burn energy because leptin's not here to tell me. And meanwhile, leptin's banging on the door like, I'm right here. But it can't get in. It can't talk to the brain. And so that becomes known as leptin resistance. Right. And if you have both, then it's a double whammy against you, because you continue to, well, as we know, the diabetes, insulin resistance is the long-term outcome, right? Heart disease. So we have to be very careful with it. And then leptin is not doing you any favors either, because it's making you still hungry.
Yep.
And you're not burning excess energy. And so it's terrible.
It's a really bad cycle. It is. And I've dealt with it firsthand, guys. And, you know, I try to eat healthy. There's, like I said, there's something. So, you know, it's good that we talk about this. And I, for example, with me, you know, I've always tried to watch from the beginning. I was a former athlete when I was in high school and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it comes to show you that it doesn't matter if you know, it's genetic, but like we all know at this point, a little bit genetic, but also lifestyle has a lot to do. And I know that my culprit, guys, and just being vulnerable and transparent here, lack of sleep. You know, that was always, or at least a good schedule. So circadian rhythms, what is that? HPA axis, what is it? Hypothalamic axis regulation. Yep. Right. Yep. I thought I had that at some point, but anyway, so it's good that you pay attention to your schedules to, you know, like we, you know, doctors repeat over and over, you know, try to have a schedule, try to, because it will affect you. And I am actually, you know, a live example that if you don't, it doesn't matter. Like when I went overseas to Colombia to see my mother, who actually had a stroke at a very early age, I went to a wellness center, and my doctors here had never tested my leptin, none of that. And so actually a hormonal panel is such a hassle to get them to run a hormonal panel. Short story long, like my stories, I go to a wellness center overseas and he says, let's just, they do like a German test. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's a magnetic something. I forget. You put your hand in your feet and they kind of scan.
Oh, yeah.
What is that called?
Yeah. I don't remember what it's called, but I know people have done it.
So I was fascinated. And what it does is it scans your organs, your hormones. It's very comprehensive. And I was fascinated. And he comes back and he says, your leptin levels are off the charts. What is going on? And I said, I have no idea. I don't sleep. And he said, you tell me you're the, and I said, I do know. And he said, tell me. And I said, I think lack of sleep. He said, it's true. And because if it would have been diet, and you know, I don't eat, I at least try not to eat all the junk food and stuff like that. He said, I would have seen your cholesterol, triglycerides and everything else. Mm-hmm. And my insulin resistance wasn't as bad then, but it was off the charts. So, the reason why I'm talking about this is because functional medicine, naturopathic medicine, we, you know, they address the root cause. They don't just look at the symptoms. They address the root cause. And this is how I found out. So at that point, I was able to make a decision and say, what do I do? So he said, might as well eat the junk food if you're not going to sleep, because it's not doing you any. So at that point, I made changes. I fixed my leptin, but then my insulin kind of like got off the charts. But so that's what you do. You know, be proactive. Thank you for being a good sport and deviating from the topic. So going back to the mitochondria that we're talking about, what cofactors, one of your other amazing posts read, cortisol starts and ends in the mitochondria, like we're talking about before. Mm-hmm. So what cofactors do you recommend for overall mitochondria health?
Yeah. And there's a lot. There are a lot. CoQ10 is a huge one. CoQ10, your B vitamins, magnesium, carnitine, L-carnitine. It's a very long word and we all just shorten it to call it PQQ. And that's usually what the supplement's called, PQQ. Can all be really helpful as cofactors for the mitochondria.
Wow.
CoQ10 is a really big one. Now, what's interesting is that mitochondria, you know, improve with exercise. So your weightlifting, your HIIT training, anything that's like building that muscle can improve mitochondria. Intermittent fasting for people who are into intermittent fasting or fasting mimicking diets have been shown to increase mitochondria. I get asked, can you test mitochondria? Well, if you were born with a deficiency or an issue with mitochondria, that's different than just people who maybe have unhealthy mitochondria. Maybe they've been exposed to chemicals. Maybe it's from stress. Maybe they were smokers, you know, in their younger years, and that affected their mitochondria. They just don't exercise anymore. They don't have the time. And things have slowed down for them. They're not sleeping very well. And so what happens is just your mitochondria get less healthy. But the great thing is, it's from my understanding, is that it's, you know, like we can turn this cruise ship around. We can start movement. We can get back into exercise. We can read labels, avoid chemicals. We can add in some extra vitamins. I mean, even taking a good quality multivitamin and a B complex can be a really great start for a lot of people, just to amp up their nutritional coenzymes and co-nutrients, especially because we know our food is, you know, it's not like what it used depleted. To be. So even organic, it's depleted. Yeah. So people say, well, I eat organic. I'm like, me too. It's just me too. The fields and the farms just aren't as nutrient rich as they used to be. And then other people are like, I can't eat organic. I don't have access to organic. I can't afford organic. I'm like, I get it. Absolutely. But it's the same thing. That food's depleted too.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I actually wrote an article just touching that a little bit on how to eat organic on a budget. So if you guys want to check it out on my website, but also something that, you know, if you have the opportunity, I actually don't have a backyard. I have a community garden, and I took advantage of that. And it's been, you know, since we moved in, we've been gardening. I didn't have, obviously, much of an idea of gardening, but I learned, and today we have a nice, you know, plot, and I plant so much in there, you know, the soil, you know, we use organic soil. I use a little bit of compost, so on and so forth. So you could, those are also steps that you could take if you can't afford even just pots. You know, I know of friends who have they put it in the balcony. Every little bit helps, and definitely, you want to stay away from pesticides. That's something that, you know, we always emphasize. Yeah. Awesome. So let's just jump real quick to the next one. You had a case in one of your posts with a patient with PMS, fertility, and thyroid. And I thought that was pretty interesting because sometimes people don't tie them together. So why don't you tell us a little bit about this combination and why they're crucial in determining fertility issues and also thyroid?
Yeah, absolutely. You can hear my dog barking in the background.
Yeah, that's fine. I heard the landscape is outside. He's better than the landscape.
So thyroid is really important, really crucial for how our menstrual cycle works as women. And so the thyroid can impact, like, how many days do we bleed? How heavy do we bleed? How is our PMS? How often do we get our period? Do we skip our period? The thyroid can impact all that. And so working with women for a lot of years on fertility, thyroid is always one of the big first things that I would check, because if their thyroid was not balanced or healthy, like, that was the first thing we would work on. Because yes, a lot goes into fertility, but the thyroid just has such a huge impact. And I had so many women where we figured out it was their thyroid, and within a couple months, you know, their periods normalized, they got pregnant, everything was great. And so I think it's important that women understand to ask for thyroid testing, and not just the screening. My dog is going crazy.
Our
neighbor's landscapers are out.
Hey neighbor, we're trying to record.
I know the FedEx guy, like, he lets me know about everything. And so with thyroid, you want to make sure you're testing all the markers. So there's the main marker most doctors will test is called a TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone. But you want to make sure you test the downstream active hormones known as free T3 and free T4. And if you have family members with thyroid issues, for sure you want to ask for what are called the antibodies. You want the thyroid antibodies. And that's where we look at the autoimmune, known as for Hashimoto's, for low thyroid. And then the opposite, hyperthyroid, if they suspect that, they'll check you for Graves' disease. But what drives me nuts is that women come in and I'll say, well, have you had your thyroid checked? And they're like, oh yeah, I got a TSH and it's all normal. I'm like, oh, but so many things falsely make TSH look normal. For example, leptin. Leptin will falsely make TSH look normal.
Oh, wow.
When really you have a thyroid problem. But just looking at that one marker, it's a fake out. It gives you a false sense of security.
No kidding.
And so that's why you have to look at the whole big picture. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Leptin will also affect the way that you make T3, is my understanding. And so you can become hypothyroid-like because of leptin.
Wow.
And so,
Guys, and when you think it's getting easier, it's actually getting more complex. But
it's a spider web. That's what I said. The human body is like a spider web. You literally can't pluck one string by itself. The whole web will vibrate. Yeah,
that's why the Dutch test is so crucial, guys. I'm going to put a link, obviously, you know, in her dedicated page for the podcast. I am actually going to do it myself real soon. And so what I was going to ask you is, I know that, you know, when you go to conventional endocrinologist, they say, well, your TSH is normal or within range. But I know that in functional medicine, naturopathic medicine, they have different numbers. Correct me if I'm wrong. between, it's supposed to be between 0.1 and 1.5. You tell me, what do you guys consider to be optimal?
The actual range of TSH is, I think, is like 0.5 to 5. It depends on your lab, 0.5 to 4.5. Sometimes the lab will say 0.5 to 4. That's the, like, the general world range. But optimally, we actually shrink it down. We actually are looking, most of the time, depending on the practitioner, we're looking at like from 1 to 2 or 1 to 2.5, depending on your doctor, on your practitioner. And then it depends, you know, like your medication. If you're on thyroid medication, that can actually really suppress TSH. So maybe you might be under 1, but for the average woman, we tend to look in that 1 to 2-ish.
Oh, that's
range on a TSH.
Awesome. Great. Okay. You guys, now, you know, if you're having symptoms, you still don't feel well. I've heard that for years. You know, if you don't feel well, still is because all of these things, you know, your leptin might be out of range. TSH is not optimal. That's what they focus on, you know, naturopathic medicine. Mm-hmm. Excellent. So let's just jump to the other one. Thank you so much for answering that. I don't know what kind of short on time. I don't know how much time you have.
Unfortunately. Okay, yeah.
Cool. So we're going to jump on. This is the last question. Hormone tests and timing. That's why I said we're going to come back to this. When is the best time to test your hormones? And I know that's kind of like a general question.
I love that you asked this question. No, it's a great question. I love that you asked this question. Women. I don't know why my dog is losing his mind.
He wants to be part of the podcast. He's like, that sounds like a lot of fun.
I know. Usually he's asleep at my feet. And today he's decided to like tell the whole neighborhood what's up. So women, if you are cycling, if you have a normal cycle, the first day that you bleed, the first day of your period is known as day one. You're going to count forward on a calendar and you're going to collect a test, a hormone test, somewhere in the day 19, 20, 21 range. That's what you're going for. Technically, you would collect 5 to 7 days after ovulation. So for those of you women listening who actually know when you ovulate, you track your temperature, you feel the mucus changes, you would go, okay, this is when I ovulated. 5 to 7 days later, you're going to check your hormones. The reason is we're trying to catch your peak progesterone and your estrogen at that time. In the first part of your cycle, by your period, your progesterone is super low. It's normal. Mm-hmm. You don't make progesterone to the second half. You don't make it until you release the egg ovulate. So it drives me nuts. Or when women go to the doctor and then they'll bring me their hormone test and I'll say, well, when did you get this done? And they go, oh, on Tuesday at 2 p.m. Like, well, where was that in your cycle? And they're like, I have no idea. Yep. it's really calculated where you test. Now, if you are menopausal, if you're like, well, I haven't had a test in or a period in months, you can test anytime. Mm. Anytime. Doesn't matter. Because you're not on a cycle like a woman who gets her period every month. If you have irregular cycles, let's say you have PCOS, let's say you're perimenopausal, let's say you just have, you know, whatever thyroid issues and your cycle's all over the place. Call the lab, whatever lab you test through, and they will help guide you as to when the ideal time to test is. Because it depends if you get your period every 2 weeks, or if you get your period every 2 months, or maybe you haven't gotten it in 6 months, like they're going to guide you on how to test. But if you get your period and it's pretty regular-ish, you want about 19, 20 or day 19, 20 or 21 after the start of your period.
Wow. That is very important. Yeah. Thank you so much for answering that. It's so important, guys. Look at that. And that's you're 100% right. You go to your OBGYN, go get tested. They don't tell you, wait, you know, I had no idea. I was actually 5-7 days after ovulation, like you said, correct? So we will take those, you know, I'll take some notes for you guys and, you know, we'll learn a little bit more about that. So, this basically concludes our podcast. Dr. Carrie, is there anything else you would like to add before we leave?
Yes. And I love that you said that sleep is your big issue, because the number one and number two people that tend to stay up later at night are my moms and my entrepreneurs.
Yes.
Because y'all get that second wind. You put your kids to bed and now you're like, whew, finally the house is mine and I can get everything done I need to get done. And you do. And then you stay up late and then you mess up your rhythm and then it affects your health. And so I have to tell my moms and my entrepreneurs, I get it. Trust me. but just, you know, keep your health in mind. Maybe try not to stay up too late. You know, maybe not stay up every night of the week, you know, like really try to shut it down earlier. Your body will thank you.
Awesome. Beautiful advice. And as usual, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your knowledge. It's an absolute pleasure to have you. We've learned so much. I cannot wait to have you again. And guys, mm-hmm. I just wanted to say you could follow Dr. Actually, do you have a website yet? I don't know if I got that. Why don't you share your URL?
Yeah, I have two. So one is dutchtest.com. That's all my webinars, podcasts, everything's up there for free. And then my personal website, which is just basically kind of a copycat of Dutch, is drcarriejones.com. But dutchtest.com is where you will find lots of free information.
Excellent. So guys, don't forget to visit dutchtest.com. There is tons of information there. I know because of the posts that Dr. Carrie shares. You can also follow her on her Instagram account at dr.carriejones and also on her Facebook account at facebook.com drcarriejones as well. Is there anything that you're offering right now that they you would like to our audience to know, anything that you are working on, something that you're it's coming up, a summit, anything that you would like our audience to learn about?
Education is the kind of our theme at Dutch for 2020. So be on the lookout. We're going to have a whole lot more like basic how-tos, 101s, webinars. All our webinars are free. And so we just really all about people, men and women, understanding hormones, understanding stress, understanding cortisol, understanding their bodies. So just be on the lookout, stay tuned. We offer it to anyone who wants it, and you can be empowered.
Awesome. Looking forward to that. I'm definitely going to keep an eye on that and share it with you guys. Dr. Carrie, again, thank you so much for being here, and looking forward to having you again.
Oh my gosh, me too. Thank you so much.
Awesome. All right. I'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Hey guys, so today might be your lucky day. I am going to be picking one lucky reviewer and they'll get a bag of organic turmeric. So you could make all that golden paste and all that good stuff. So again, one lucky reviewer, you could leave a review either on iTunes, your favorite podcast channel, or also on Podchaser. So go ahead and leave a review. Today might be your lucky day.